From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a moment in American history we are all familiar with. The 1865 assassination of Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater. John Wilkes Booth with his fateful cry and his leap from balcony to stage. America in another divided time. But what you don't know about Booth and that historic, horrific April day might surprise you tonight on Point, the story behind the myths of the Lincoln assassination and John Wilkes Booth. But first, we begin tonight with the latest on Iraq. In response to continuing attacks and ambushes, the Pentagon has opted to cut back on American ground convoys, replacing many rolling supply lines with airlifts. Also, Pentagon officials said today that the Bush administration plans to ask Congress for $80 to $100 billion to fund military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan next year, up from the $70 to $75 billion the White House projected for members of Congress before the election. Mark Mazzetti is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and joins us tonight. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me again.
A lot out of the Pentagon today. We're hearing more about how supplies will be flown around Iraq, more about how much more the war there will cost, and American generals saying that this insurgency is growing more effective all the time.
That's right. The news about the convoys came out yesterday. General Jumper, who's the Air Force Chief of Staff, told reporters that the Air Force was basically trying to pick up some of the slack in dealing with these convoys, and saying that, you know, because so many of the convoys are getting shot at and bombed and, shot with grenades, they would try to airlift some of the supplies to the troops in Iraq.
But is it realistic to move all that weight and food and water and supplies to the air? Can that really be done?
You can certainly defray some of it. You cannot move everything into the air. It would be impossible. I mean, they run over 3,000 vehicles a day currently into Iraq to resupply the troops there. So you're not going to be able to take it over entirely by the air. But you can, to some degree, lessen the burden on the ground convoys by doing it by the air. The Marines are also doing this currently in some of their bases in the Sunni Triangle.
I saw something like 30% of U.S. cargo ferried into Iraq is water, drinking water for the troops.
That's right, and so now they're thinking about trying to distill purify water up in Iraq, so you could cut down on the number of water convoys going in from Kuwait along those dangerous roads from Kuwait into Iraq. So again, they're looking at every possible way to not only cut down the number of convoys, but cut down the need for the resupplies from Kuwait.
Mark Mazzetti, how should we interpret this? Does this mean that U.S. forces are to some degree surrendering the ground to Iraqi insurgents, or just trying to cut down on casualties, or both?
Well, there's certainly a concession that the roads are not safe. If you're driving in a green vehicle that is has U.S. troops on it, you're a target, and you might be bombed or shot at. I don't know.
It's a pretty big concession.
It is a big concession, and but the Air Force, certainly to their credit, is trying to save lives and cut down on the number of attacks. Again, you're not going to be able to do this entirely, but there is I think an admission by commanders in Iraq that you're not going to be able to secure every roadway in the country. I mean, if you look at just the roadway from Baghdad out to the airport where the main military base is, I mean, that in almost 2 years hasn't been secure. So there remains remain big problems along the roads.
Expensive to do things by air, and the price tag for the whole operation going up toward $100 billion, up from the $70 or $75 billion that had been discussed earlier. How did the government explain the much larger request that they're likely to put in?
Well, we've known about a large request for quite some time. They really don't explain the number. They say that the price tag for Iraq is running at about $4.4 billion a month, so they're going to need that much. It's as simple as that. It also, I should say, includes Afghanistan. But this was somewhat of a political football, because we knew that they were not going to make this request before the November elections, because it would become an issue in the presidential campaign. So they certainly waited until after then, and so we can expect it sometime soon. And it certainly will be a fight in Washington, but one wouldn't expect this would not pass.
And the comments from Air Force Lieutenant General Lance Smith today, talking about the insurgency, saying they have a growing understanding there that they can affect the logistics flow, that they're becoming more effective, that as we adapt, they adapt. What's the general trying to get across to the press, to the public, when he describes, perhaps it's just a fact, but when he goes out of his way to point to the increasing effectiveness of the insurgency?
Yeah, it's something that generals and Pentagon officials like to say. They say that, you know, the insurgents are going to school on us.
Mm-hmm.
They understand our tactics. They understand the way we operate, and they can then target us more effectively. And so, consequently, we try to change what we do. But you know, I think that this is an effort on the part of officials, in many ways, to lay the groundwork for what is expected to be a dangerous and bloody time up to the January 30th election in Iraq. And so, you know, every top official has said expect more attacks, expect a increasing level of violence. And but they say that they expect the insurgency to be diffused after the elections. And I guess we'll just have to see.
Mark Mazzetti, do they say that with conviction? We hear an awful lot of concern about what might lie on the other side of these elections. Do you hear the Pentagon uniform staff saying we really believe these elections are going to take some of the tension out of this wire?
That's a good question. It does depend on who you ask. There is a lot of hope, let's put it that way, that the insurgency will lose steam after the elections. And, I mean, I think there's a plausible case to be made. The more it looks like there's going to be a democratic government in Iraq, the less the insurgents may feel like they can effectively derail it. This would be said that we were told that the insurgency would be going down after the handover of power from the CPA to the Iraqi interim government, and we've seen the level of violence go up. So, again, we'll have to see what happens after the election.
Mark, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Mark Mazzetti, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. April 14th, 1865, the formal surrender ending the Civil War at Appomattox was barely 5 days old. More than 600,000 Americans in blue and gray had died on battlefields, still soaked with blood. The future of the United States, a house then still bitterly divided, was uncertain, and the shocking finale for citizens of a war-weary country was still to come. Just after 10 p.m. that spring night in Washington, the actor and Southern loyalist John Wilkes Booth strode into the presidential box at Ford's Theater and shot Abraham Lincoln in the head. The story of that night, the assassination, the conspiracy to murder the president, and the man who pulled the trigger is the story of a defining moment in American history. Its legacy and impact have risen to the level of national lore. It is a story where myth has often overpowered fact. This hour, On Point, a new and provocative look at John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln assassination. You can join the conversation tonight. What is your mental picture of John Wilkes Booth, the man? Do you know what's fact and what's myth in your understanding of Abraham Lincoln's assassination? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Owings, Maryland, is Michael Kaufman, author of the new book, American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Conspiracies. Good evening and welcome, Michael Kaufman.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you in a terrific new book. I look forward to diving into it with you. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
So, Michael Kaufman, you've got it in detail like maybe we've never seen before, and it's a story that you've not only researched in a scholarly fashion, but very much lived in many ways. You spent a lot of time haunting the ground of the assassination and of John Wilkes Booth.
Well, that's right. One critic called it a sort of weird method acting, and I didn't actually think of it that way when I was doing some of the things I did. I just saw it as an opportunity came up to do something that would help me understand the events a little bit better.
You certainly threw yourself into it. You've made that 12-foot leap from the presidential box to the stage of Ford's Theater. You've given tours for 20 years of the ground that John Wilkes Booth covered, even burnt down a Civil War-era barn, I'm told, to see what that would look like. Of course, that was his last. That's how he was finally captured, burnt out of that barn.
That's right. It sounds a little obsessive, but the real story is that I was trying to do a video documentary on the events surrounding Booth's death, and we had an opportunity to recreate the final scene using real Civil War reenactors and an actual barn that dated back to that time period. So I figured, hey, why not?
You've looked at all of this through the murk of myth that's risen up around the Lincoln assassination over these many, many years now. Help us for a second identify what are the most common myths that Americans tend to carry around in their minds about John Wilkes Booth and this assassination?
Well, I think so many books about the Civil War era are written in sort of an us versus them mode in which the Southerners were against us Americans. And when they see Booth in that light, he is not only one of the outsiders, but he's also evil incarnate. And he's everything that he did was of animated by a sense of pathological evil. And it springs from our sense of Lincoln as an almost godlike figure. And and if he is up there, then certainly Booth has to be down there somewhere.
So if one is God, the other has to be the devil. But yet I don't really see you picking up a wholly sympathetic view of John Wilkes Booth in this
book. Well, not at all. And I had to deal first with that idea that Booth was really the ultimate evil. And when you start to research his life and the things that people said about him, you find that the theatrical critics thought he was perhaps America's best actor, certainly one of the top two or three, and that he was a very much beloved person who was passionate about poetry, who was very well educated, almost a brilliant man, and didn't have a touch of vanity, loved children, and all this kind of thing. And so you end up with this problem as a writer in trying to explain a person who, to all appearances, is a very charismatic figure. Everyone seemed to like him, and there didn't seem to be anything wrong with him, but he committed this horribly misguided, at the very least, crime. And you're trying to square those two was really something that led me to the belief, which I held for a long time, that that he was sort of emblematic of the Civil War, that he was one of those persons of great internal contradictions, you know, that he was a patriot and a traitor at the same time.
We're going to have to hear more about that. I hear you describing John Wilkes Booth as a kind of swell guy who made an inexplicable error. It looks like something grander than that, and clearly your book says so as well. American Brutus, you call the book, and in a way, him. Why Brutus?
Well, John Wilkes Booth came from a long line of very political people. His father and grandfather in particular held very strong political beliefs that were of what today we would call civil libertarians. That is, we have this strong, solicitous feeling about the individual over the centralized government. Booth had always opposed the tyranny of the crown. And
I mean, that's one way to put it, but he was a great enthusiast for slavery, not exactly a civil libertarian's meat.
Again, and we come into the contradictions again. Everywhere you go, really on both sides of the Civil War, you find these contradictions that I think help pull us along, create this mystery that makes us want to learn more about the period, and in a way, let's everyone see the war and the people in it any way that he wants to see them.
Jack Beatty, Michael Kaufman's opening here with a very sympathetic kind of cracking open of the door on this story. and yet at the end of it, the man who saved the Union, if that was your perspective, and surely sitting here today, we're all the beneficiaries of that, was dead.
That's right.
Yes, he was dead, and I'm trying to fathom his motive from this fascinating book, but I'm struck with this, that he was at the gallows where John Brown was hung. He got himself.
John Wilkes Booth was there.
Yeah,
the abolitionists at bay.
Yeah, he got himself up there to Harper's Ferry and with the militia. And seemed to see in the figure of Brown, whom Emerson said consecrated the gallows, made the gallows holy. He seemed to see something of a reflection of the role, and even a manipulative madman can play in history. And I'm wondering to what degree that even influenced.
We'll be back with more. We're looking at John Wilkes Booth, The Story. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about political violence in a divided America, about John Wilkes Booth and the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. Our guest tonight is Michael Kaufman. He's author of the new book, American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Conspiracies. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you imagine a time when no American president had ever been assassinated, even at the height of a civil war? And can you imagine the storm in the mind of John Wilkes Booth? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. One of the things that Michael Kaufman pulls together in this remarkable book is a lot of diary writing from John Wilkes Booth, excerpts from the diary that he kept while he was on the run from Union soldiers following the assassination of President Lincoln. The excerpts run from April 14th, the date of the assassination, to around April 22nd, 1865. Booth himself was killed on April 26th. On Point's producer Chris O'Connor has read some of these for us, so we can get a flavor for this man as we talk with Michael Kaufman. Here, in his own words, Booth describes the moment he shot Abraham Lincoln.
Ti amo. April 13th and 14th. Friday, the Ides. Until today, nothing was ever thought of sacrificing to our country's wrongs. For 6 months we had worked to capture, but our cause being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done. But its failure was owing to others who did not strike for their country with a heart. I struck boldly, and not as the papers say. I walked with a firm step through 1,000 of his friends, was stopped, but pushed on. A colonel was at his side. I shouted, "Sic semper," before I fired. In jumping, I broke my leg. I passed all his pickets, rode 60 miles that night, with the bone of my leg tearing the flesh at every jump. I can never repent it. Though we hated to kill, our country owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment. The country is not what it was. This forced union is not what I have loved. I care not what becomes of me. I have no desire to outlive my country.
The words of John Wilkes Booth in his own diary, kept after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, when he was on the lam from Union soldiers who were tearing up the countryside to find him, and find him they did. Our guest tonight, Michael Kaufman, author of American Brutus. So many questions and issues raised just in that reading, Michael Kaufman. He says, "I cried sic semper," as in sic semper tyrannis, thus ever to tyrants, I guess. And he talks about how an effort to capture Lincoln had failed, and so he moved ahead on this front. I want to come back to that as part of the conspiracy. He also says he broke his leg in the fall. As I understand you say, no, he didn't. We need to hear that. But I wish you'd just walk us through the events of that night for people who remember them gauzily or don't really know them. What happened at Ford's Theater?
Well, John Wilkes Booth had worked for a long time to capture Lincoln, and had worked with a number of other people.
To capture him? To what end? Not kill, but capture.
Well, that's right. He presented it to the other people involved, some boyhood friends and some others who eventually came in, the idea being to force the Lincoln administration to resume an exchange of prisoners of war. During 1864, during that particular summer, the re-election campaign for the president heated up so much around the issue of starving prisoners and
Andersonville and all the rest.
That's right. We've all seen those pictures of what looked like living skeletons. And in the North, they blamed it on sheer brutality of Southerners. In the South, they blamed Lincoln and the new general-in-chief, General Grant, who were adamantly opposed to exchanging prisoners, and the South said if we could exchange them, they wouldn't be dying like this.
So they wanted to take Abraham Lincoln hostage and hold him in exchange for a large number of Southern prisoners?
That's right. And when Booth presented this to people, he was able to give his intentions a sort of humanitarian cast,
mm-hmm.
that people who joined his conspiracy were not necessarily killers. In fact, only one seemed to have it in him at all. But these were people who felt that they were saving the lives of prisoners of war.
At what point did he drop the conspiracy approach and go straight for the kill?
Well, you know, that's the magic question. Everybody, up until my book came out, everybody has said that only on the day of the assassination, you see, that's what Booth wrote, up until today, nothing was thought of sacrificing our country's wrongs we had worked to capture.
Mm.
Now, what I say is that Booth had deceived the people in his plot, that he had repeatedly cast aside opportunities to capture Lincoln, and he seemed to have no explanation for that. Finally, when he got together with his people for the first and only time, all of them together in one place.
How many people are we talking about?
Well, there were 8 put on trial, but there were 6 at this meeting,
mm-hmm.
which was exactly a month before Lincoln died. In March of 1865, they got together, and at some point, Booth started making noises about doing something more than capture, and a fight broke out between Booth and one of the men, a guy by the name of Sam Arnold, and Arnold said, I didn't get into this, you know, to give my life in some harebrained scheme.
Mm.
What they had been discussing was a new plan on Booth's part to capture Lincoln in a theater. Up until this point, Booth had been telling people, at least he'd been telling Arnold and Michael Laughlin, another Baltimore friend, that they were going to capture Lincoln on his way out to the soldiers' home out in the country.
And you describe how little, amazingly little, security there was around the American president in those days.
You just wouldn't believe it. When Lincoln went to bed at night, he had to think occasionally about tourists waking him up to ask for an autograph. He lived in a public building, and nobody thought at that time that they had the right to close this building up. When they finally got guards in the White House after the re-election, which was a very bitter contest in 1864.
No guards until then, despite the fact of a civil war just miles away?
They had soldiers out on the lawn who sort of came to regard themselves as a bodyguard unit, but they were not walking around with the president everywhere he went.
Mm-hmm.
And the Washington Police Department assigned 4 men to the White House in November of 1864. This is almost four years into the administration.
And what about at Ford's Theater that night? What was the security there?
Well, there was none. There have been a lot of stories over the years that a man did come along. His name was John Parker, who did come along and then abandoned the president by going off to have a drink. But that's a series of misunderstandings. They actually filed charges against Parker, and he was acquitted.
How did John Wilkes Booth make his way to standing with a pistol immediately behind Lincoln?
Well, Lincoln was in the box with his wife and with a young couple, Henry Rathbone and Clara Harris, and they occupied a double box that had been opened up into one. There was a small passageway leading from the balcony or dress circle into that double box, and what Booth did was he walked along the back of that balcony, presented either a card or an envelope or something to identify himself to a man who just happened to be sitting out there, who turns out to be a White House messenger. And that man, like anybody else would have done, he let Booth in.
Mm.
At that point, Booth got into this small, dark passageway where nobody would see him.
Let me just ask you this. Did he recognize this famous actor, John Wilkes Booth?
We don't know because it was such a very different world at that time. Apparently, nobody thought to question this guy about it.
That's different, all right. So he walks in.
Oh, so he walks in, closes the door, and he pulls up a wooden bar that he has placed there earlier in the day, and he braces the door shut with that bar. So he has now barricaded himself inside with the president and his party. Nobody even knows he's there. So he turns
including the president. He's in the passageway behind the president.
That's right. He's in the passage, a small, dark passageway, right behind the president's box. Up ahead of him is an open door, and he can probably see Henry Rathbone and Clara Harris up ahead looking down, which would be to Booth's left, looking down into the stage watching the play. So he takes just a couple of brisk steps forward, and at that point he's at the point of no return. He pulls out a single-shot Derringer, and steps into the middle of the box and turns to his left, points to Derringer almost point blank at the back of President Lincoln's head and fires.
President Lincoln died the next morning at 7:20. John Wilkes Booth, ever the actor, took this dramatic leap then onto the stage. Is this where he cries out, "Sex Imper Tyrannis," sort of the phrase attributed to Brutus in the murder of Julius Caesar?
Well, what happened was he dropped the pistol, and Henry Rathbone, who was startled, hadn't noticed Booth was there, jumped up, and Booth lunged at him with his dagger. And Rathbone took a cut all the way to the bone in his arm. And then Booth leaps over the railing of the box and jumps 12 and a half feet down to the stage. He then, of course, feels this quick rush of adrenaline, gets a little dizzy, sets himself, gets up, and in a very theatrical way, he raises this bloody dagger over his head and he yells, "Sic Semper Tyrannis." And that was the motto of Virginia, "Thus always to tyrants." It sort of epitomized the feeling that Booth's and people like them had over the centuries, that the way to deal with a tyrant is to kill him.
Didn't actually break his leg there, as he claims in his diary, according to you?
He claims he did. He claims he said "Sic Semper Tyrannis" before he fired. He claims that he was stopped by a colonel, implying, I guess, that an armed man was there, but of course Rathbone was not armed. He said that he passed the pickets and rode 60 miles that night with the bone of the leg tearing the flesh at every jump. I mean, we heard those passages from the diary, and they are all exaggerations. When Booth wrote those things, he was trying very hard to convince the world that he was not a coward like the newspapers had been saying, that he had taken a lot of chances, that, in fact, he had injured himself in the process. And, again, the only thing that we believe out of all of those things Booth said is the bit about breaking his leg. He did not ride 60 miles. He rode 30. The bone was not tearing the flesh of the leg.
Was it broken there in Ford's Theater?
I believe it was broken later. He didn't show a trace of anxiety. He did not limp when he went across the stage. And this I get by confining myself strictly to the eyewitness accounts that were taken that night and in the next couple of days.
And meanwhile, the man who saved the Union, bleeding in the balcony, and would die. Let's hear a bit more in John Wilkes Booth's own words. Here again, from his diary, kept in the days following his assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Here he describes being on the run and the betrayal he felt when he discovered that those who had once supported his cause had turned against him after this act.
After being hunted like a dog through swamps, woods, and last night being chased by gunboats till I was forced to return, wet, cold, and starving, with every man's hand against me, I am here in despair. And why? For doing what Brutus was honored for. What made Tell a hero? And yet I, for striking down a greater tyrant than they ever knew, am looked upon as a common cutthroat. My action was purer than either of theirs. One hoped to be great himself. The other had not only his country's but his own wrongs to avenge. I hoped for no gain. I knew no private wrong. I struck for my country, and that alone. A country groaned beneath this tyranny and prayed for this end. Yet now, behold the cold hand they extend to me. God cannot pardon me if I have done wrong. Yet I cannot see any wrong, except in serving a degenerate people. The little, the very little I left behind, to clear my name, the government will not allow to be printed. So ends all.
There it is, in the words of John Wilkes Booth. Jack Beatty, this kind of this note of grandiosity, greater than Caesar, greater than Brutus, and self-righteousness in a man who's just assassinated the president is just breathed to this day in those words.
Yes, and you almost feel that he's intoxicated in the way he would have been as a performer, that somehow the line between art, make-believe, and life is one that he kept blurring and in this act crossed. I mean, a theatrical assassination. It almost seems more like a legend to him than something he really did, the kind of distance from his own act that this gives him. And, you know, that whole picture is very interesting as he's talking about it. And it reminds one of the Maryland connection here. I mean, the notion that Lincoln was a tyrant. Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus and really made a kind of internal war on civil liberties, so the Democrats, so others thought. On the other hand, there were rebels all around. But the place this really began was Maryland. And John Wilkes Booth was from Maryland. Mm. And it was in Maryland that there was a famous Supreme Court case where basically the president said, you know, about a man's civil liberties, and Lincoln basically said, I'm not going to abide by the court. So he's just throwing over even the courts. And the New York Times...
Maryland, which swam all around him, which was unreliable for a leader of the Union in its
yes,
leanings.
Yes, and there was a plot to assassinate him mm-hmm. when he was passing through Maryland mm-hmm. in 1861. And the New York Times wrote this about him, describing this picture of Lincoln as a tyrant. No living man was ever charged with political crimes of such multiplicity and such enormity as Abraham Lincoln. This is written in 1864.
And not a Richmond paper, but
the
New York paper.
This is the New
York
Times. He has been denounced without end as a perjurer, a usurper, a tyrant, a subverter of the Constitution, and destroyer of the liberties of the country. And, of course, Lincoln would have said, well, there's a war on. And his great retort to this is, shall we allow all the laws to be violated but one, and therefore sort of hold that one fanatic mm-hmm. that you know, a person has to be given his rights before a court, all the laws but one, but you know, John Ashcroft and George Bush might say similar things about, you know, they're often attacked.
We're under attack here, ladies and gentlemen.
Under attack here. You liberals are attacking us for civil liberties. My gosh, they attacked Lincoln for the same thing.
Michael Kaufman, do you feel that resonance in your work?
Absolutely. I started writing this book on September 10th, 2001. And what happened the next day was in my mind through every page of it. And I was just not only struck by the similarities and the parallels in history, but also by the lessons we could learn from that that one very visible case from back in the early days of this kind of approach to dealing with national emergency.
Well,
I should say, by the way, that when you look at the American Civil War, you find it pretty hard, really, to see how our present times, as bad as they are, can compare when possibly even a majority of people, certainly half the public, was at one time or another within that group that could have called themselves subversive, and you didn't know how to identify them. They were right here in and among the people who were supporters of the administration, and they were numerous, and they were violent, and it's...
They're truly the divided nation. We've got to take a short break. Michael Kaufman, author of American Brutus, stand by. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about political violence in a divided America, about John Wilkes Booth and the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. Our guest is Michael Kaufman, author of American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth, and the Lincoln Conspiracies. You can join us as well. How do we process the fact that such a great man could be brought down by one angry actor? Southern listeners, how do you see John Wilkes Booth's act today? Has the South risen again in its contemporary political ascendancy? If Abraham Lincoln had lived, how different might history have been? What a story. What a time. And it all depends on how you look at it. You know, I come from a very old Illinois family. Abraham Lincoln lived with my great-great-something, Aunt Polly, for a while in New Salem when he was just getting started in that country. Michael Kaufman, it's all about this savage offense against the native son. But as you say, many perspectives on this. Richard's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you this evening?
Well, thanks. Well.
Good. I'm looking forward to reading the book. I'm a historian here in Concord, and as a kid, one of the first books I read was The Day Lincoln Was Shot by Jim
mm-hmm.
Bishop.
Yeah.
So that kind of started me on my career. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious that, you know, I think that in a lot of ways the Civil War, no surprise, is still being fought depending on where you live, north or south. I think that at least Southerners that I've talked to over the years kind of view John Wilkes Booth almost as a hero, because he was taking care of, you know, when he kept saying his country, I am assuming that he was talking about perhaps the Confederacy, and the fact that they recently put a Lincoln statue in Richmond to a lot of public outcry, to me, shows that in a lot of ways the country's still very divided over whether Lincoln was a tyrant or the savior of the Union, depending on which side of the Mason-Dixon line you live on.
Let us pick it up with Michael Hoffman and Richard. Thank you for your call. Michael Hoffman, maybe first the place to go is how the South responded then. You report that not only were the newspapers not entirely favorable by any means, but that the safe houses that John Wilkes Booth thought would be open to him actually closed. How much of that was out of fear of the oncoming North, and how much was out of revulsion at this killing? There was no precedent for the killing of an American president.
Well, that's right. And an interesting surprise that I came across in writing this book was that there was a marked difference between the reaction in Maryland and the reaction in Virginia. When John Wilkes Booth was escaping, he went through southern Maryland, and everywhere he went, people did shelter him, did feed him, give him newspapers and whatever it was that he asked for. But when he got into Virginia, he was very much disillusioned to find that everyone he spoke with gave him basically two words: get lost. He was from the poorest people to the richest.
Out of fear, because they knew the Union troops were going to hound him, or because they were disgusted?
Well, there may have been some fear in it, but I think the overriding factor in this was that Robert E. Lee had surrendered less than a week before the assassination, and Robert E. Lee surrendered the Virginia troops. Mm-hmm. People were very state-oriented, and in Virginia they never developed the very personal, very visceral kind of hatred for Lincoln that they did in Maryland. They were just sort of on the other side. He's a Yankee, we're rebels, fair and square.
But there was a surrender, so honor was in play here.
That there was a notion of honor. There was the notion also that Robert E. Lee had surrendered all Virginia troops, and for us, it's over. Let's leave it at that. And they were getting used to that idea. They were looking forward to peace, even if they hadn't won the war. Many of the people in Virginia felt very strongly that the worst thing that could have happened was for a pro-South person to assassinate Lincoln, who was known to be somewhat lenient toward the South compared to many of the politicians in Washington, and they felt that they were all going to be blamed for this. Now, in Maryland, where Booth came from, it was different, because throughout the war, the lack of civil liberties in the state, which as was pointed out earlier, was
severe,
begun in Maryland but spread to the whole country. It seemed to be very personal to them, because even though they were strongly pro-Union sometimes, even though they were against slavery, they were still considered traitors because they were in that group of people who were living among a very noisy bunch of pro-South neighbors. Maryland had a gatekeeper position. They surrounded Washington on three sides, and they were in position to choke off, if not completely stop, the Union war effort as the troops tried to come through.
And the animosity was deep there. I want to get another call here. Andrea is calling from Harlem in New York. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually grew up near the Brandywine Valley, near the Mason-Dixon line in South and Southern Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we still called it the Mason-Dixon line there.
Sure.
Maryland was considered the South. But I learned recently, and hopefully you can shed some light, because perhaps Mr. Booth is sort of this, rather grandiose figure, however, of a Hegelian dialectic. I had learned that apparently when South Carolina seceded, that in effect there was this disruption of the Constitution, and that we then were put under a military provisional government, but that the corporations were raping America. And that with peace, and that there were some official declaration where Congress would be forced to reseat itself, that Lincoln then would be declaring peace, and it would remove us from being under this military government, but that the assassination that perhaps Booth was an effectuator of on behalf of the corporate interests.
Andrea, let's give it to Michael Kaufman. Assassinations breed all kinds of ideas.
There are so many different theories about why Booth killed Lincoln, and what I decided to do was stick with Booth himself and look at what he said, what he talked about, what he wrote about, and where he came from. And what I see is so overwhelmingly political and overwhelmingly oppositional, I should say, that I really didn't find any evidence that Booth was thinking in military terms, was thinking in terms of the sort of military-industrial complex, as we say today.
And you explicitly refute the idea that he was a puppet of larger interests.
Well, if you see how he manipulated people in such a cold and cunning way, and it really is sort of an evil genius kind of approach that he took. He, as we discussed before, he was an actor, and he seems to have scripted this thing in such a way that people were given roles to play without actually knowing it. He had this almost Shakespearean drama going on, but it was all real life. And to see a person capable of doing such a thing, it's very hard to see that same person as a puppet of anyone. You get the overwhelming sense that he had to be the one in charge, or else he didn't want to do it.
April 26, 1865, John Wilkes Booth shot and killed in a tobacco barn in Virginia. The shooter, what you described as an overeager Union sergeant named Boston Corbett. The barn was on fire. Corbett, his own kind of bizarre story from those days, a born-again Christian zealot who had castrated himself to extinguish sexual temptation after the death of his young wife and newborn child. You go back in history and things always get wild. How did they finally trap John Wilkes Booth there?
Well, initially they were chasing the wrong people. There were a couple of decoys sent out by one of the Confederate men Booth had contacted in Maryland, and word got back very late, like a week later, that two people fitting the description of Booth and his companion David Harold had gone into Virginia. It was the party chasing those two people, those decoys, who eventually accidentally struck the path of the real Booth. It came about because there weren't that many roads that led south, and you know, if you're going to chase somebody who you presume is heading south, you kind of have to go on that one road that's going to cross over the river. Heading in that direction. So they ended up going to just the right place, and they had pictures of Booth and Harold and others. And a man said, yeah, they were here 24 hours ago.
And soon the barn was on fire, and John Wilkes Booth would be dead. Jack Beatty, well, there's no proper coda to all this. A huge mountain of detail here.
Yes, there is, including this. An African-American woman sobbing was watching Lincoln's body being carried into the White House, and a sadistic man in the crowd taunted her by saying, with Lincoln gone, she'd have to return to slavery. Oh, no, she wailed. God ain't dead yet.
That from Michael Kaufman's American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Conspiracies. Michael Kaufman, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, remembering the Battle of the Bulge. This is On Point. Tomorrow is the 60th anniversary of the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge, one of the most critical battles of World War II. In December of 1944, Adolf Hitler decided to launch a risky offensive against Allied forces in the Ardennes highlands of France and Belgium. The Allies were taken by surprise, but largely held their ground at great cost during more than a month-long battle. U.S. forces suffered a stunning 80,000 casualties. Germany lost more. By the end of that January, the Allies had retaken the land they had lost, and as Russian troops pushed in from the east, the German defeat was all but inevitable. Author Alex Kershaw has researched the story of one of the key American units in the Battle of the Bulge, the 394th Regiment's Intelligence and Reconnaissance Platoon. Despite being outmanned, the platoon successfully slowed the initial surprise German advance. They were eventually forced to surrender when they ran out of ammunition, but all 26 members of the platoon survived the war. Here, Alex Kershaw reads an excerpt from his new book, The Longest Winter, when the platoon is under fire in Belgium.
In their dugout on the extreme right of the position, Sam Jenkins and Robert Preston had by now run out of ammunition for their bar and were using their M1 rifles. Jenkins couldn't understand why the Germans were attacking again without artillery support. If they brought just one tank into play, they would all be quickly blown off the hill. He fired again and again, knowing it was vital to hit the Germans before they got close enough to throw a grenade through the hole's firing slit. Nearby, Private Louis Khalil suddenly noticed that some of the Germans were fanning out and trying to infiltrate through the position's flanks. A few feet from Khalil, Sergeant George Redmond was squinting through the sights of his M1. To the left of the dugout, a German paratrooper crawled along the rock-hard ground. He got to within 30 yards of Khalil and Redmond and then quickly aimed his rifle, loaded with a grenade, and fired. It was a superb shot. The grenade entered the dugout through its 18-inch slit and hit Khalil square in the jaw. But it did not explode. Instead, it knocked Khalil across the dugout to Redmond's side. Khalil was half-stunned as he lay sprawled on the base of the dugout. Redmond dropped his rifle, grabbed some snow, and rubbed it in Khalil's face. Blood gushed from Khalil's jaw. The force of the impact had forced his lower teeth into the roof of his mouth, where several were now deeply embedded. His jaw was fractured in three places. Redmond sprinkled sulfur powder on the wound and then pulled gauze out of both their first aid kits and started to wrap Khalil's face. There was no morphine in the kits to kill the pain. Once the shock wore off, Khalil would be in agony. "How bad is it?" asked Khalil. "Oh, it's not too bad, Louis," said Redmond. "But I've got blood all over myself. It can't be very nice. It's not too bad." "Okay, I'll take your word for it." Khalil knew Redmond was trying to make the wound sound a lot less severe than it really was. He could feel the teeth embedded in the roof of his mouth cutting into his tongue. The battle still raged. Small arms fire sounded like radio static during an electrical storm, a constant ear-piercing crackle. Redmond's fingers did not shake, despite his fear, as he wrapped the last of the gauze around Khalil's jaw. He knew the Germans could penetrate their position any moment. If they were to stand a chance, they would need to return to firing as soon as possible. Redmond tied the last gauze bandage and met Khalil's gaze. "Don't worry about it," reassured Redmond. "If things get to where you can take off, then take off," Khalil replied. Redmond looked at Khalil fiercely. "We're staying here, together." "All right." Redmond grabbed his M1 and began to fire. Khalil was now in terrible pain, but did the same, aiming with the use of just one eye at the figures that still approached up the blooded hillside. It was so cold in the dugout that Khalil could feel blood freezing to his face, stemming the flow from the wound. The damned cold had been good for one thing, at least. In the desert, he would surely have bled to death.
Alex Kershaw is author of The Longest Winter, The Battle of the Bulge, and the epic story of World War II's most decorated platoon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.